Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. Today we have a very interesting show where we actually have a round table. We're going to talk about criminal justice and the Department of Justice for the United States. On today, our special guest, we have the round table. First of all, Leonard Bailey, who is special counsel for the National Security in the Criminal Division, Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section. We have C.P. Craig, who is lead faculty at Colorado Technical University, and Paul Schmick, who is a media coordinator, professor, and the vice president of security technology at Alliance Security. Welcome to everybody on the panel today. Thanks for joining. All right, so we're going to kind of go through some topics here that are relevant to the cybercrime, criminal justice arena, and we had a list of bullet points. I'm going to talk about each topic and then let everybody kind of give me their ideas about them. But first of all, we want to talk one at a time with all the panel members. Tell us about yourselves, how you got to where you're at, and your background. We'll start with C.P. Craig.
With a repeat of what I previously stated, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance is my background, both as an aviator, what I did within the Marine Corps, flying and commanding an ISR asset, got involved in defense, homeland security, emergency management business when I retired out of the Marine Corps, transitioned that into homeland security, and got heavily involved in the biometrics business for quite a number of years, and then other defense and homeland security things, such as port vulnerability and assessments way back in the early days of that. Anyway, that's pretty much it.
All right, we'll move over to you, Paul.
Hello. So back in late 90s, not to show my age, but late 90s started in the datacom environment in the New York metro area, more on the telecom and data side. And as security technology has just continued to just dominate in terms of industry growth, I spent some time in government, left government in 2016, and hold the current position where I am right now, where I'm responsible for security technology deployments for both private industry and government organizations, everything from access control to video surveillance, and also sell cybersecurity as a service to our clients, which has helped kind of expand the areas from just security to more information, technology, and security. So glad to be here today and looking forward to the call.
All right, thank you. And Leonard?
I've been with the Department of Justice for now 27 years. I bounced around in various divisions. First, I came into the Terrorism Violent Crime section, second special counsel and special investigative counsel to the Inspector General of the Department. I was a senior counselor to the Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division. A few years ago, I was an associate deputy attorney general, responsible for cyber policy for the department for the deputy attorney general. And I am currently special counsel for national security, where I work kind of a range of issues that cut across criminal and national security concerns in the cyber realm.
All right. And thanks for joining today, all of you. Definitely our special guests, Leonard and Paul and CP, will help kind of with our roundtable. But let's take a break real quick here, hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
The new cyber frontier. Today, we're talking to our special guest, Leonard Bailey, Special Counsel for National Security at Criminal Division of Computer Crime and Intellectual Property. And on our panel, we have Paul Schmick and CP Craig as well. So our first topic we're gonna discuss here, kind of in the root of criminal justice. What are the most significant, current cyber threats that we're seeing in this area? We'll start with you, Leonard.
Sure, I'm going to give your normal lawyer's answer, which is it depends. what our experience talking to various organizations that have been hit by cyber incidents is that the nature of the cyber threat and its severity depends on the nature of the business. So if, for example, you are a business that really relies on communications, you're dealing in financial transactions and must track those very closely, you losing your communication system is going to be truly problematic. Whereas if you're a manufacturer, it will be a problem to have your email and VoIP systems go down, but you will still be able to operate. However, if you are a manufacturer, for example, who has a large customer database and you lose all your customer information, that's a whole different problem. And if you're a manufacturer who has intellectual property that's a crown jewel for your company, if that gets stolen, that is going to be truly tragic and possibly an existential problem. What we take from that, and we've had these roundtables with cybersecurity firms to ask them what they're seeing with their clients, one thing that we keep hearing is that companies, in preparation for cyber incidents, often don't do the math. They don't figure out what are their crown jewels, what are the things that they really must protect, which is a challenge. Another important, because you can't protect everything, and often figure out how to prioritize. How you manage the risk well requires you to figure out what are your weak points and or the things that really must be protected. The last thing I'll say is, all that said, there are certain types of malware that are particularly concerning. Back in 2012, when certain wiper viruses popped up, so Saudi Aramco was hit by a wiper virus, the Shimun virus, that took out about 30,000 computers, about three-quarters of their corporate network, we're told. That was of great concern. We had we're concerned that we're going to see something similar here, and we didn't exactly until Sony in fall and winter of 2014, when they were hit by the Guardians of Peace organization that has been linked to North Korea by the government. That was the one instantiation of microviruses. The more recent ones we're seeing are things like ransomware, which is in some ways a form of that. But rather than entirely brick your computer, it simply obviously makes it less available. It makes data unavailable to you, makes the functioning of your computer unavailable to you until you pay a ransom. And that has been very prevalent, very successful for criminals, and really a subject of some focus by us.
Yeah. So I've heard this story for a couple of years now, talking about companies are not identifying crown jewels behind. Are they getting any better? Has the awareness that you've heard coming out for the last couple of years, are we seeing improvement in this area?
So I would say yes. I think your C-suite is really understanding the potential downsides of not being prepared much better. The problem is it is truly a complex problem. It is a technical problem. It's a training problem. It is a governance problem to try to get companies to deal with these things well. Going back to Sony for a moment, it's also just a problem of figuring out what is your Achilles heel. So everyone also hit in two other ways. They had four movies that had not been released, stolen, and then released to the public before they had screened, which presumably hurt those in the box office. And secondly, and perhaps more problematically, they had what we call doxing. They had a whole tranche of very sensitive emails that were stolen and again posted that resulted in damage to relationships, the airing of various grievances from inside the company that were never intended to see the light of day, and that was a whole other bit of harm. So IT companies are getting better, but this is a truly difficult, complex problem that requires sort of constant attention.
Yeah.
And just to pick up where Leonard speaks really articulate about it, it's, and we're looking at the C-suite, and you specifically mentioned that it's taken on that the C-suite has to look and gauge risk.
Yeah. CP, any comments on that?
Well, I would have to throw in, I mean, just the other day, in the press or media, I should say, the announcement was made that the Navy had a contractor whose database of information involving some significant classified projects had been invaded. And going back to protecting the crown jewels, this was a serious issue. And by the way, as DOD tracked it back, they were able to determine that the Chinese had actually were invaded this particular site and had removed that information. And the Chinese are on a major technological development crush, and they're demonstrating a level of flexibility in the cyber world that is rather interesting and amazing. One, they're very focused on what they want to take technology-wise, and they're also pretty focused on what they want to be able to impact from any potential adversaries. And I think we kind of forget the historical perspectives here. Back in the 90s time frame, the French were our major industrial spies and thieves looking to steal industrial secrets. We forget the Israelis and Jonathan Pollard were heavily engaged in doing similar things against the U.S. Navy. So there is a historical precedent. The only difference is where and how we store information. We no longer need James Bond with a camera because somebody sitting in China can actually break into something in Washington, D.C. and steal the information.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. So it is a continuing and evolving situation for us as the nation. And we need to look at it both internally as a homeland security issue and externally as a national security issue. And it goes across all of our industries.
Yeah.
So it is involving everybody. It is part of the enterprise.
Yeah. So, from the Department of Justice level, you have a good picture of, what the future looks like. Can you give us, Leonard, some ideas of what you see coming down on horizon for things that we're going to have to address? I know this IoT buzz is everywhere, but what is it that you're mostly concerned about moving forward?
Tracking trends is really, it's very, very difficult. The experts I've talked to have said, for example, you may be able to, 3 years out, make some guesses, but beyond that, you're just making stuff up. And so one example of that is, earlier this year, we had this uptick in cryptocurrency mining malware, which makes a lot of sense because against the backdrop of these sort of sudden spikes in cryptocurrency valuation, it makes sense that suddenly there would be efforts to use the processing power of computers and even mobile devices that won't be compromised to mine cryptocurrency. But you had to see or guess that spike was coming in order to have identified that as a place of growth for a certain type of threat. And that's one of the challenges, figuring out exactly how, in our case, focusing on the criminals, how criminals will attempt to monetize whatever they typically do with computers. In some instances, historically, it's been stealing information, credit card information, personal information that otherwise can be turned into used in fraud or other schemes, and selling that on some dark market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, things you see with things like the cryptocurrency mining, and it's funny because everything old is new again, is that was not about stealing information, that was about stealing your resources, because that was, for them, a more fertile way of making money. What will be the next easiest way of making money? Unfortunately, I'll come back to it, but ransomware will stay with us for a while simply because it works.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's more stable in some ways than the other ways of monetizing goods. The other ways were based on what is your information worth to others on the black market. The beauty, the horrible beauty of ransomware is, the question is now, what is your information worth to you?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so for most people, they have set very good price points such that people will spend a few hundred dollars to get their data back. And it has invariably rid of one Russian national who we charged with running a botnet and the CryptoLocker currency, we allege has made $25 million in 2 months just by running that ransomware globally.
Wow. Yeah. Let's take a break real quick and hear from our sponsor.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Over 3 million data breaches happen every single day. That's over 2,000 records being compromised every minute. So often, we focus on securing web data access. But what if the attackers are already inside, having gained direct access to your storage through data management software? When it comes to communications that go directly into your storage devices, make SNIA your first line of protection. SNIA's conformance testing limits outdated communications that are known to be used by attackers. It works continuously behind the background to make sure your storage is protected. To find out if your data is truly secure, visit our website at www.snia.org/cybertest.
Back to New Cyber Frontier. We're speaking with Leonard Bailey, the Special Counsel for National Security at the Department of Justice for Crime and Intellectual Property Section. And also our panel that's helping out with the interview. Before the break, we were talking about what we see on the horizon and what's the big picture that we're from the Department of Justice level. You have a good perspective, I hope, on maybe making some assessments of what the trends are. Paul or CP, do you have any thoughts on this section? Looking at what we heard from Leonard before the break.
We're trying to place a lot of attention.
Interesting. So, CP, did you have any comments on that?
Well, yes. Thank you. The insider threat, as we think back on all these active shooter situations, is the same in terms of a actual physical threat. So, that is a serious issue. How do we recognize it? How do we identify it? I think, you know, step number one in anything is detection and identification. And that is the difficult thing to do in the industry, whether it's a virtual threat or a real threat, physical threat. So it's going to be a challenge, but I think education is the first step.
Yeah, definitely.
Can I add one thing to that?
Go ahead.
This is Leonard again. That's a great point. We've worked with a couple of companies on the issue of insider threat monitoring, and it likely is, you know, will be a burgeoning area, but it is also an area that is, for many, one that prompts a lot of concern. Images of Minority Report type predictive capabilities that are hugely intrusive. But there are some very interesting things that are happening with those sort of like indicators and bits of telemetry that people are trying to analyze to determine, you know, how you identify someone who is on your network as an employee and likely to being either in the future engaged in malicious conduct or currently is engaged in malicious conduct. It's a scary area to a lot of companies, but things like big data and other things where there are, you know, collections of data that may be used in mind to identify how other threats materialized, I think is helping that along.
Okay. So the next topic we had, so we just had the GDPR new regulation last month go live, and privacy is on the top of everybody's mind here lately. What does the future of privacy look like in the United States related to investigations, the Department of Justice? What are we going to do to maybe even match what we see happening over in Europe? Yeah, it sounds like that you're not really you're looking at how you can enforce and work with the laws that are existing. But as far as the the opinion of people in the United States. Do you see that's going to change and we're going to move in more of a direction like they've done in Europe? What's your feel from kind of the top of this?
So I it's a very good question. I find this very difficult to predict personally, because I think that there is, you know, at heart a very different approach to privacy generally in Europe versus in the U.S. There are differences in our expectations of privacy, and they cut both ways. In some ways, you know, the folks in Europe would at points say that they have higher standards, and yet if you look at very small countries and the number of wiretaps they do in a year, they actually dwarf the number of wiretaps that we do here in the U.S. And so, you know, there are kind of disparate standards that are being applied. You know, in the U.K., they don't have a First Amendment, so the way in which they approach certain issues differ. That's not privacy, but it's a related issue. I would be surprised if we just adopt what exists in the EU. This is my personal opinion. I think it'll be something that will have definitely will reflect in some ways the unique strain of kind of how we approach this in the U.S. under our Constitution, which I think is the real framework that we hearken to figure out how we should think about privacy.
Okay. Paul, CP, any comments or questions for Leonard in this area?
No, I think he speaks to it accurately, and I think this is, I hate to say it and to use the cliche, but I think this is a wait and see. I think we have to see how this rolls out in terms of, and how it impacts us based on our laws, because there's a legal component, a compliance component. We're typically sensitive to data and our protections in the U.S. So I'm kind of just monitoring and seeing how the EU goes about it before it's going to be difficult to paint that picture of how this rolls out in the U.S.
Yeah, I think we're all on a wait and see right now. How's this going to roll out? I definitely can see that one. CP, any thoughts?
I think the big challenge is, how are we going to apply this internationally? The speed at which this is moving is faster than the laws can be written, and in many cases faster than the law enforcement agencies can operate on it. And how do we enforce it? How do we make those arrests? How do we investigate it? These are all international questions, and the United States may be at a bit of a disadvantage here, because our current administration doesn't seem to be as engaging with our international partners as perhaps the administration needs to be in certain areas. So it can create roadblocks for us in that area. And it almost may come down to private industry solving the problem for private industry.
Good thoughts on that. So if we take a step in a different direction, we turn the camera in on the Department of Justice and cybercrime in the United States. Leonard, what are some of the like shortcomings that you might say there are things that you're dealing with cybercrime and law enforcement here in the United States?
Well, I hit on the first one, which is sort of the international challenge. That manifests in a couple of different ways, you know, externally in terms of international investigations, how well we are working with foreign partners on conducting investigations. So many of the computer crime cases we work have an international element, either because of electronic evidence is in those countries or because the actor is in another country. On that one, we are getting a bit better. We have announced some, I think, pretty impressive prosecutions of international cyber criminals. 27-year sentence for Roman Zelezniev last year, who was a carder, focused on credit card theft, a recent prosecution of Vladimir Trinkman. But in addition to the sort of external issues, there's the internal issues. do our laws allow us to get that data, or do our laws only have domestic application, meaning that if you are a provider using cloud services, that data is beyond our reach. That was the case that went to the Supreme Court. There was oral arguments, and ultimately it was mooted as a result of the passage of the Cloud Act just a couple months ago that resolved the issue, we think, amicably, that made it clear that, yes, our domestic laws do allow us to use U.S. authority to get the data that's stored abroad. To clarify the law in that way. Other than that, I mean, the other things that you would expect our problems are things like keeping pace with technology and the rapid shift in the manner in which both the technology is developing and security is being applied. Our job is getting harder, not easier in many ways when you look at things like, I guess, for example, today, Apple announced the release of this new iOS that will make it more difficult for us to get information that we were obtaining using kind of third-party solutions. So that looks like it will keep moving. And so those two things I would suggest are two significant issues.
Interesting. So it sounds like a lot of kind of jurisdictional across boundaries. Where's the data at? Where's the system at? Where's the company at? What kind of, who has the rights over it? In some areas, we might not even know where the data is at or things are stored in the cloud because it's done dynamically. How are we going to address things like that?
So that came up. That was actually, following the Microsoft case. And in the Microsoft case, it was a very concrete problem because Microsoft had the files that we had obtained a warrant for stored in Ireland. Mm-hmm. We knew where it was. That's where it was. Following on that case were a number of Google cases in which we were attempting to get emails from Google, and they were using a cloud architecture, which meant that they were unable to tell us not only where the data was stored right now, but where it would be stored the next moment. And that, in our mind, underscored the unworkability of a law that said we couldn't direct essentially a provider to gather that information and produce it here.
Mm-hmm.
So far, for example, the Cloud Act, we feel we've gotten some remedies. The issue of, for example, the cloud will continue to be a security issue. Some people embrace it a little bit as a panacea, but what we've seen is people still have to be very aware of what sort of security services are being applied to their data and services in the cloud. In some ways, it's not just have a benefit, but in other ways, it doesn't mean that you don't need to still be attentive to that.
Yeah. It seems like, too, that as we move more towards where GDPR is pushing, the individualization of privacy, companies and governments, oversight, whatever, might have less capability by technology implementation. Technology of the future might say the individual is the only one that can get into this or private data because it's encrypted and we don't keep the key as a company. We don't want it. Heading towards that direction of individualized privacy, what do you see the landscape being almost it's almost like a battle with companies where they're saying, we don't want to have access, we make our technology so the individuals are the only ones that have access. What do you see when that kind of comes to light more?
So I think that harkens to a very fundamental question that we're facing, I think, as investigators, and that is, there was a time when we viewed the ability to investigate and enforce our laws as a very serious, significant public policy need, which meant that, that's why we have things like subpoena authority or grand juries or orders or warrants that allow us to gather information as evidence in support of determining whether a crime has been committed and there should be punishment meted out. at what seems to be a trend in various places to think of anything that allows more effective investigation as being necessarily bad, notwithstanding what protections are wrapped around it. Just the ability to achieve an end with investigation seems to prompt a certain reaction among some. One example that didn't involve the federal government at all, but was the this recent use of the family tree DNA information to track a serial murderer out in California. The thing that was interesting was that this someone who was purportedly responsible for 50 rapes and allegedly 12 murders in the 70s and 80s. But the first reaction to that was, and I think I have a quote here from an article, said that this could dampen the current enthusiasm for DNA-based family trees. It was first the concern about, oh, look what they did investigatively, isn't that concerning? There may be further questions to be asked about that, but that seemed to take precedent over, and they found a serial murderer. So I think norms are changing, views are changing. I think law enforcement is trying to make its case better, but we're seeing some erosion in our ability to do a lot of the things that we think are necessary to enforce the laws.
Yeah, interesting. From the panel, any thoughts on this area?
I guess I have to look at it two ways. First, as a law-abiding citizen who loves to see criminals, particularly a serial rapist and murderer, caught, convicted, and incarcerated, good on that. As a private citizen, I have to think about how far does the government get to go. And then again, I look at what are the steps that companies are taking. Some of the DNA companies are making their databases so they're not publicly available. We, of course, saw the issue that Department of Justice was having with Apple and some of the other service providers in terms of providing backdoor entry methodology to their mobile devices. And that creates both issues, concerns, and problems as a society, as a government. Those are things that we're really going to have to think about and have a public discussion as to what is acceptable, what isn't acceptable. I don't see the answers written on the wall, and I don't see a rapid solution, and in fact would be very leery of a rapid solution that should be led by Congress in that discussion, and that doesn't seem to be happening today, but it needs to happen.
Yeah.
And just to pick up where TV's talking also with Congress, so when you look at the Cybersecurity Act of 2014 and 2015 and what they intend to do with engaging private industry and with government, I think it was some important steps to rely on each other to open up the communication in terms of intelligence sharing, which I know we could probably do a separate podcast just on intelligence sharing in the cyber world, but that's really where we're going to be able to establish boundaries, and we're in a global interconnected world, and every day it's more and more connected, and we're crossing boundaries with laws and investigations, which impacts, as Leonard's talking about, the criminal justice arena, so it's still maturing, and I think private industry is finally warming up that they can be part of with government and not fear retribution as they share data breaches and risks and threats. And it's an important first step with that trust, and because I don't think any entity can do it alone. I don't see government fixing the solution alone. I don't see private industry fixing it alone. I see it as a cooperative responsibility. And that's kind of some of the areas that I'm always trying to be keen to. When I look in the media and where the industry is headed, and if we're heading in the right direction, the challenging part is why are the consequences more severe, and why is the theft more severe in terms of financial loss? So those are just some of the areas I think that are important on a high note to look at as this continues to mature, this industry.
Yes, and we want to...
And if I could just add to that,
go ahead.
I 100% agree with that. One of the things that makes this so difficult is the fact that it's a problem that has concert by multiple parties, from private sector government, one of them, but you know, domestic, international partners, even down to customer versus vendor. You know, you have all of these schisms, but you know, folks who have to kind of get on the same page to make something work.
Yeah. All right, so we went a little long today, but this has been such an interesting discussion, and I'm so honored to have this panel on, and Leonard Bailey, especially you, to talk about from the top, from the DOJ of the United States. In closing, is there anything that you want to get out to our listeners, anything you could use help with, call to actions that people might be interested in? Thanks, everybody, for joining today. Thanks for joining today. It was definitely a great conversation, and I thank you all for being a part today.
Thank you.
The views or opinions expressed during this podcast are not those of Colorado Technical University.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.